I'm Aaron Hagen, in for Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Last week, the House voted with an overwhelming majority to end the National Security Agency's bulk collection of phone and email records. This vote comes after a federal appeals court ruling that the NSA had violated citizens' privacy and exceeded the boundaries Congress had authorized. In this first hour of Midday, we probe into the details and discuss NSA security measures moving forward. Also ahead, is technical hardware a thing of the past? Baltimore-based editor of the IT site Ars Technica, Sean Gallagher, attended Microsoft's Build conference earlier this month, and he joins us in the studio to tell us about how we better get used to holograms. That's Midday on Tech, after the news at noon. Welcome to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dan Rodericks. We're coming to you from 88.1 WYPR in Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, WYPO Ocean City, and Maryland's Eastern Shore, and streaming online at WYPR.org. Thanks for joining us. Last week, the House passed a bill, the USA Freedom Act, to rein in the federal government's bulk collection of phone records. This comes after federal appeals courts found earlier this month that the NSA's collection of metadata, phone numbers and times and locations and durations of phone calls, this was not authorized by the Patriot Act. In the unanimous ruling, Judge Gerard Lynch, he wrote that Section 215 of the law could not be interpreted as justifying the government's actions. He writes, "Such expansive development of government repositories of formerly private records would be an unprecedented contraction of the privacy expectations of all Americans. Perhaps such a contraction is required by national security needs in the face of the dangers of contemporary domestic and international terrorism, but we would expect such a momentous decision to be preceded by substantial debate and expressed in unmistakable language. There is no evidence of such a debate in the legislative history of Section 215, and the language of the statute on its face is not naturally read as permitting investigative agencies to do any more than obtain the sorts of information routinely acquired in the course of criminal investigations of money laundering and drug dealing." Again, that's the ruling as stated by U.S. Federal Court of Appeals Judge Gerard Lynch. Section 215 is due to expire on June 1st. Joining us to talk about domestic surveillance is Ian Duncan, who covers intelligence and military topics for The Sun. Ian, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in the studio is Midday on Tech contributor Sean Gallagher. Sean is the Baltimore-based IT editor of the site Ars Technica. That's a site that covers technology news, tech policy analysis, gadget reviews, software, and more. And Sean, thank you for being with us as well.
Good to be here, Aaron.
Listeners, have you got a burning question or comment of your own about the NSA surveillance program, or maybe Edward Snowden's uncovering of this program back in 2013, or the future of the Patriot Act? Your voice is, of course, welcome in this conversation. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or toll free at 866-661-9309. And you can always, of course, send us an email at midday@wypr.org. And Ian, let me begin with you. A little bit of context here as we set out on this conversation. The Patriot Act, the sun setting on this Section 215, and now the Freedom Act. What's changing legislatively and why?
So the idea in this House bill is that it would change from the FBI and the NSA getting all of these call records and shifting them over into a huge database that's held by the NSA to the phone companies, you know, keep these records anyway for their own purposes. And it would enable the FBI and the NSA instead to dip into the records of people who they think are terrorists or linked to terrorists and just pull out a narrower selection of records rather than getting the whole thing.
So this is a dialing back, not an eradication of what was previously in place.
That's right. And so the argument that the people who back this legislation make is that we're not taking this capability away, but we're just changing the way it works in a way that they think will protect people's privacy better, but still allow the NSA to, you know, keep an eye on terrorists and potentially bring cases against them.
So that's the language of the legislation. Sean Gallagher, how does this work on a technical level?
Well, on a technical level, the way that it's worked in the past is that the NSA has collected all of this data from the phone companies directly on, through an ongoing FISA warrant, and put the data in its own databases. The NSA has invested a lot of money in database technology of various sorts, and what this system was able to do was essentially create a map of relationships between different phone numbers, so that if you were to find a relationship between a suspected terrorist or someone else of interest with other numbers out to three hops out originally, they would be able to dive deeper on those phone calls and get more information on them. Because they held all the data, they were able to sort of have computers run through all of the data without human beings looking at the phone records themselves. So the justification was that they weren't actually diving into individuals' phone records. No human being was looking at them, but computers were. And the problem with that was, as many people felt, was that when you have this three hops, that, as they called them, of relationships between phone calls, many, many people are three hops away from each other. And, you know, you could call the same pizza restaurant and have a relationship with a terrorist, essentially. So it exposed a large number of people to this sort of probing of phone records, since they mapped all these things out, much like Facebook. They would follow relationships all the way out in a graph database of how they interacted. And innocent individuals could get scooped up into that, and that had been documented as happening in a few occasions.
Let me ask you guys a question. Do you think that this dialing back is because of a certain legislative idealism, or is it being facilitated by the fact that they just got to dug themselves into a real informational mess and they found out that this is not that effective?
I mean, the reviews of this program, the stuff that's been declassified, they haven't really been able to show that it's been useful. There's one case where maybe it helped them find somebody who wasn't really planning to attack America. They were involved in potentially terrorism in Somalia. You know, the supporters of this program, people in the Senate especially, say, well, if we'd had this before 9/11, we would have been able to find some of the hijackers, and that's why we really need it. But that's really a hypothetical question, one that we can't know the answer for sure.
And it's a huge investment in terms of the amount of storage that the government has to keep on hand, amount of hard drives that they have to keep all this stored on, and the technology required to churn through it. And it, while it does theoretically present an opportunity to find relationships that could be helpful in warning of an impending attack, as Ian said, there have been very few cases where they were able to show any sort of concrete connection between it. The government goes through also, the NSA has many other types of surveillance it does overseas, and of the internet itself at nexus points of the internet where it's crossing U.S. borders, and that's collected even more information. That's not being changed by this. This is just changing the phone records collection.
Help me understand a technical element of this whole project, and that is, it seems to me that this level of data collection can't happen without so many levels upon levels of automated algorithms. Aren't we essentially like building roboticized systems to do this surveillance work for the actual humans in the agency?
What the NSA built is essentially a Google in reverse. So instead of having Google to search the internet, they have a Google to search everybody using the internet. And they've created this system that allows them to, it's called X Key Score, which allows them to search through all internet traffic over a 5-day period to find individual things that match algorithms, that match patterns, that match specific rules they've set up to flag traffic as being interesting. And that and the search engine that they essentially use, the graph database they use to track relationships between phone calls, these are all very similar to technologies that Facebook and Twitter and folks like that use to handle our daily conversations, only they're using it with our phone conversations. And with X Key Score, it's the internet, all the traffic on the internet. So, and when I say all the traffic on the internet, I'm saying all the traffic that crosses American borders through the connections to international cables, to submarine cables to Europe and Asia, but also going across the border to Canada. And that's not just traffic that's destined to people in those countries. A lot of our telecommunications traffic, because of the cost of things, travels over American borders just because it's the most efficient route to follow. So Americans' communications with each other could theoretically be caught up in this.
That's Sean Gallagher, IT editor of the site Ars Technica. Ian Duncan of The Sun, talk to me some more about the policy debate around this issue. Have we got universal across the aisle accord here? Is everybody happy with the fact that this Section 215 is reaching its rightful sunset and is going to be replaced by a more constrained version of itself?
So in the House of Representatives, it really seems to look that way. The vote last week was pretty overwhelming. Some people voted against it. I think a lot of them, that was because they thought this didn't go far enough, not because they wanted to see this program carry on the way that it's working now. In the Senate, it seems a lot less clear. Mitch McConnell, the leader in the Senate, has introduced a bill that would just reauthorize this for a couple of months to try and buy a bit more time. He said that he'd quite like to see it keep working the way it does now. Marco Rubio said the same thing. A lot of important, influential Republicans in the Senate don't seem to be on board with the USA Freedom Act.
Listeners, I want to remind you that you're welcome in this conversation at 410-662-8780 or by email at midday@wypr.org. Are you satisfied with this legislative turn of events? Are you skeptical? Is this too much? Is it not enough? I'd also love to hear your thoughts, listeners, and your questions, and maybe your personal observations about a recent bit of government surveillance that happened right over our own heads here in Baltimore City. This was a surveillance operation that involved two Cessna small-engine airplanes flying in curious circular patterns over the city during that period when we experienced protests and civil unrest a few weeks ago in the wake of Freddie Gray's death. Again, listeners, the number to join us, 410-662-8780 or by email at midday@wypr.org. And Ian Duncan, you reported on this story. Tell us what you know about this domestic aerial surveillance operation here in our city.
So we know the FBI acknowledged that they did do some kind of aerial surveillance over Baltimore, or at least that they provided aircraft. They sent this very FBI statement that sort of said, yes, we supplied aircraft. They didn't say if they were flying them, if they have some contractor that flies them. It's all a little bit vague. But some people who are kind of into aviation and know how to track some of this stuff down found these three planes that are flying very odd formations over the city, circular patterns. ACLU is trying to find out from the FBI if these were the planes that were doing this surveillance of the protesters on the ground.
And they were all registered to companies, not to the FBI. They were all registered to shell companies or plane leasing companies rather than the government, although they did squawk a law enforcement signal as their identification while they were flying over Baltimore.
Do we know exactly who it was that requested this surveillance?
According to the FBI, the Baltimore City Police requested aerial assistance in spotting possible criminal activity. That was the statement that they made.
And talk to me, gentlemen, about what was the nature of the information collected, the nature of the surveillance. Infrared? Are they collecting
right.
serial numbers on cell phones
well,
in the area?
We don't know whether there was any electronic surveillance going on in terms of picking up wireless signals, although that's been done in the past. The U.S. Marshals Service has flown airplanes with a device they call Stingray or a dirt box, which is essentially a fake cell phone tower that picks up information from cell phones in an area so that they're able to track geographically where cell phones are, as well as potentially intercept phone calls from numbers they want to get the information from. So that capability exists. We don't think or know if that was being used aboard these aircraft. We do know that the FBI maintains a fleet of aircraft that have fairly sophisticated infrared and electronic optics to do high-definition surveillance of areas day and night. These aircraft were flying during late evening and nighttime hours. They were likely using infrared technology to watch for people who are breaking curfew.
That's Sean Gallagher of the Baltimore-based IT site Ars Technica. Also in studio, Ian Duncan, who covers intelligence and military topics for The Sun. More on this subject of aerial surveillance over Baltimore, more on the Patriot Act, the Freedom Act, and everything in between. Your thoughts, of course, are welcome. 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin in for Dan Rodericks. I'm joined this hour by Sean Gallagher, the editor of the Baltimore-based IT site Ars Technica. I should say also he's a contributor to Midday on Tech. Also in the studio with us, Ian Duncan. He covers intelligence and military topics for The Sun. In our last segment, we were talking a little bit about the sunsetting of Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the bulk collection of cell metadata. We got into a conversation about much more local surveillance phenomenon, these Cessna airplanes flying circles over us in the midst of the civil unrest in the wake of Freddie Gray's death. And of course, listeners, your calls are welcome at 410-662-8780. You can also send us emails at midday@wypr.org. And gentlemen, while we're on this general subject of technology and domestic surveillance, I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, the police and the government aren't the only ones ramping up their monitoring operations. You're seeing sort of an arms race of cameras here because you've got protesters and citizens following suit with their cameras and their mobile devices. And this development has really been a game changer, I think, as far as, you know, the whole social political atmosphere of protest.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're obviously seeing people using their own cell phones. And really, since Michael Brown's death last year, there's been a big drive to get more police with body cameras. And that's seen as a sort of, I guess, pro-civil rights measure. But then you're starting to see people now thinking, well, hang on, we're essentially saying that we want all these thousands of police on the streets of somewhere like Baltimore recording everything that they do. That's also potentially a big sort of surveillance tool that they'd have a lot of video footage. So it's interesting to see how those two things are in tension with one another.
In Seattle, a citizen filed a FOIA request for all of the body camera video that Seattle was collecting.
Because, freedom of information request.
Okay. Right, because the concern was is that all this video is being collected. Who's redacting it? Who's deciding how long it's valuable for? Who's making sure that privacy is respected? And he filed this request, and then he withdrew it after the Seattle police hired him to come in and build a system to essentially redact video and handle the video. Because we're talking about billions and billions of bytes of data that are being collected, many hours of video being collected from just one camera. Now multiply that by every single officer on the street in a major city, and you're dealing with terabytes, petabytes of storage of stored data that you have to store, you have to properly maintain, you have to redact, roll out, roll back and delete at some point. What gets kept, what gets thrown away, those things are big issues in these things, and that's part of the reason why Mayor Rawlings Blake put a break on the law here in Baltimore, I think, is because there was no real thought about how they were going to handle all the data.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing as reporters, we'd really like to be able to get hold of this footage, but you're starting to see the debate turning to let's make this not a publicly releasable, you know, thing. And then the question is then it is useful to the public? Does it really help us hold the police accountable in the same way if it's up to the police's discretion whether it's released or it only gets released, you know, when someone's charged with a crime? So there's definitely a lot of questions to sort of think through, technological policy questions that all need to be answered before I think we're going to see this as a really widespread thing.
The technology is one thing. Who possesses the technology is another thing altogether. Yeah. Let's go ahead and go to the phones, 410-662-8780. We have Kathy from Cockeysville on the phone. And Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Kathy, you have a question that we anticipated would be the first question whenever there's a conversation about surveillance in Baltimore. Go ahead.
Well, yes, if you look up in the sky, there's an enormous blimp that's been hanging over Baltimore for a couple of years now, and I believe it's tethered in the Aberdeen Proving Ground, and the government will tell you that they're using it to protect us from surface-to-air missiles that are coming from overseas. But if I'm not mistaken, the ocean is about 200 miles away, and the blimp can be seen from Cockeysville. So what are they looking at? And why? And why are our tax dollars paying for the government to spy on us with a blimp?
Kathy, thank you for your call. Gentlemen, this is not the Goodyear blimp. What is going on here?
So this is something that the NORAD, the military, is testing up at Aberdeen. It's designed to spot ballistic missiles, which are like cruise missiles, I guess, missiles that fly flat and quite low and fast, or drones, things that fly slow, and anything that essentially is not either a sort of ICBM that's coming from, you know, Russia or China or wherever, or is a normal aircraft, stuff that falls in between the gaps of what they have. It doesn't have cameras on it. It's not looking at what's going on the ground through cameras. These radar can see hundreds of miles in every direction, which is why, you know, it's true the ocean is quite a long way from here, but it can see that far, and it can see down to Washington.
It can basically see all the way up to New York from here. And the reason that you can see it is because it's up very high, and it's a very large aerostat. They call it an aerostat because it doesn't have any propulsion. But it uses what's called look-down radar technology. So it's up high so they can look down at the ocean and far, far over the horizon and spot things that are flying very low. So it's looking out for things that are flying on the deck, 100, 200, 300 feet above the ground or over the ocean that could be coming in and would be hostile.
So, gentlemen, is this something that is a technology that they're working on developing, or is this some kind of fully operational thing that's like in its strategic final destination? Are we stuck with this thing overhead forever now?
It's sort of operational. Now, the problem is that a lot of the money for its integration into the National Defense Network was cut by Congress. So, basically, this thing is sitting there and watching, but it's not integrated into any sort of air defense system. It's by itself standalone right now. So all it can do is they can pass information to other people, to other organizations with the military, if something's coming in. In order for it to be fully integrated into the national defense system, they would have to do more networking of the device, of the sensors in that blimp, in that aerostat, into the DoD's networks. And so it's sort of functional right now. They've tested it before over land out in at the proving grounds at Dugway, I believe.
Yeah, in the border somewhere.
Yeah, so it's been tested. This is a trial. The plans were for two of them, and to be at Aberdeen and for pairs to be stationed eventually elsewhere. I mean, it could theoretically be deployed on any U.S. coast or border to watch for anything coming across. So, you know, you theoretically could put one up in Arizona and watch the Mexican border, for example. So
we've come a long ways since the submarine watchtowers down on Rehoboth Beach in World War II, I guess. Sean Gallagher there, Baltimore-based IT editor of the site Ars Technica. Also in studio with us, Ian Duncan. He covers intelligence and military topics for The Sun. And you, of course, are welcome to join the conversation at 410-662-8780. And let's go back to the phones and hear from Barry in Baltimore. Barry, you're on the air.
Hi. Two quick questions. One, when I watch movies like 24 and all of the espionage movies, they can tap into CT cameras all over the place, like instantaneously. And when I drive through Baltimore City, I see cameras at every stoplight, basically. And are those things real time that foot all the way up to national intelligence?
No.
All right.
No. So what you're seeing, so there are a whole family of different flavors of cameras that you see in the city. The ones that you see over stoplights in the county and the city are traffic management cameras. They go to the city's traffic management center. And then there are the CCTV cameras that the police placed over high crime areas. And they're a totally separate network. And there is no central place all these go to right now. Now, there is a national fusion center here in Baltimore and also in other major cities that the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force in various cities maintains. And they can tap into some of these systems, but they don't tap into the traffic cameras in real time.
That's Sean. Ian?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the police do have access to some of this stuff in real time, but there's obviously a lot more cameras than there are police at their watch center downtown who can run them. So you'll see sometimes when this video gets released, the cameras are set on this sort of automatic pattern. They'll scan around a street And then you can see, you know, very clearly when a person has taken over and has taken control. Case people might be familiar with is the police officer who beat the man at the bus stop. That was caught by someone at the watch center, zoomed in on that, and was focusing the camera, training the camera on what was going on there.
Gentlemen, I have a question here from a listener. I guess the general sense of this is, you know, our high-tech devices can be, you know, sort of weapons for justice that we can use. They can also potentially be liabilities in the sense that they compromise our civil liberties. And, you know, the question from the listener says, you know, should we be paranoid about things like all the cameras out there now and maybe like in specifically about the GPS devices that we have in our own phones? Are those, I mean, those are obviously helpful to us, but they are potentially, you know, a liability to us as well.
I mean, yeah, these are big, difficult questions. And I think maybe what was difficult about the NSA is a lot of this stuff was being developed in secret because it was for national security. And even in Congress, there wasn't a particularly open debate about what kinds of technology was being authorized. You know, you saw this in the Second Circuit decision. The judges said, we don't really think that Congress had a clear idea about how these laws they were writing were being used. I think, you know, in this country, that's the answer. You put legal limits on the police and on the FBI and on the NSA, and you kind of have to trust that those legal limits constrain their behavior. And if you don't think they're enough, then you either sue the government and try and get the courts to change it, or you get Congress to try and change it. But yeah, they're not simple questions where you can say, here's exactly right, the right balance. And I imagine everyone's going to have different levels of comfort with that.
I think you need to make sure that you're keeping very politically aware about what's going on in Congress around privacy on an ongoing basis, around technology in particular, because of the things that have happened over the past few years. There have been multiple attempts to pass laws that would essentially create greater surveillance from the standpoint of trying to protect copyright and patent information, that essentially, you know, the things like the three strikes rule that they've been trying to get passed, to where if you have somebody illegally downloading something and they get caught three times, they lose internet forever or something like that. I know that they've implemented that in some countries. The fact is that around the world, this is an issue. Australia has recently implemented new, what they call data retention laws, which allow the government to essentially tap into all the traffic going in and out of the country and within the country on the internet to watch for security purposes. And there were similar laws passed in many European countries over the past 5 years. And we also have to be very aware of the fact that we're giving a lot of companies a lot of information about us. I would personally be more concerned about the geolocation information I'm giving Google or Apple or Facebook, because they aren't organizations we have a lot of power over in terms of influencing their policy, other than using them or not using them.
Right. And there's a certain accountability, however effective we deem it to be, when it comes to the government and all of these issues. For corporations, it's their, you know, that's their own policy.
Right. And the thing
and it's
is
it seems like it's getting harder and harder to define the boundary between those two as well.
Right. And it's very difficult for you to say not use Google, because even if you don't use Google search engine, there are advertisements that are delivered by Google. There are other things that are delivered by Google that are not visible as Google services. And you're a Google customer, whether you know it or not. And if you're using a smartphone, Apple keeps track of where you're going, where you're connecting from Wi-Fi from. They get information about your geolocation for quality assurance purposes and things like that. But all of that data goes someplace, right? And some of it's stored on your phone, and some of it is accessible to people if they get a hold of your phone. The rest of it goes into the cloud, goes into a location that is accessible by corporate systems, theoretically only by computers, but it could be accessible to people.
And I think important to remember that these two things, the private data collection and the government's data collection, is related. Like, the theory that the government relies on is you're voluntarily, you know, whenever you make a call, you're sending some information about who you are, what phone number you're using, so that the phone service works. And the legal theory is that you're exposing that information to the company, so you've given up your sort of privacy interest in it. And so then that means that the government can also come in and take a look at it. And as we expose more information about ourselves, GPS, all kinds of other things to companies, that rationale potentially is there, that the government can say, hey, you're giving this up willingly. You don't have an expectation of privacy. we can come and have a look at that too.
Right. So anything that's a business record is not protected by the Fourth Amendment.
Gentlemen, I feel this conversation is headed in somewhat of a dystopian direction here as we fear over our civil liberties and technology. On that note, Sean Gallagher, you have just come back from a tech conference. Let me see here. This is the Microsoft's, it's a Build conference for developers. This
right,
just
it's called
recently
Build,
happened.
And it's a conference for developers.
And this is basically, this was more exciting than most Microsoft conferences because they had this new technology to release, to share with the world called HoloLens.
Right. Now, they revealed HoloLens a few months back.
Okay.
And some at a press event, and some people got a chance to get a demo of it. One of my colleagues was there for the first demo. At this event, they actually had real hardware that was closer to what they're going to sell, this device called the HoloLens, which is essentially a head-mounted computer. It looks sort of like a halo you put on your head. It weighs about as much as a baseball hat. A pair of glasses, like basically looks like safety goggles, covers your eyes. And directly in front of you in your field of vision, it can project three-dimensional objects into your field of view. So the goal of this is to basically do what's called augmented reality, where you can have computer-generated objects appearing as if they are in reality, if they're right there with you, just sort of like the holodeck on Star Trek, for example. And you can interact with them by voice and by pointing. And it's supposed to be essentially an alternative interface to computers. As more and more of what we do becomes mobile, you know, a lot of us are talking to our phones all the time. We talk to Siri, say, Siri, what's going on? With the Windows phone, it's Cortana, which is named after a character from the Halo video game. And Google has this talk feature as well. Voice interfaces are becoming more and more popular because we can't use a keyboard on these things very effectively. And also, this augmented reality technology is becoming... Google tried it with Google Glass, for example, where you would...
That was kind of a bust, wasn't
it? It was a bust. It was very expensive, and it was also a limited amount of data they could fit into it because essentially it sat on your eyebrow, essentially. It was just barely in your field of view. This is something entirely different.
This is like a motorcycle visor?
It looks like a pair of safety goggles you would wear on a firing range or using a high powered drill or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But it's got a computer inside of it, and it's got a wireless networking inside of it, and it has all of these gyroscopes in it to detect what direction you're looking in. And it has a whole new Windows operating system called Windows Holographic, which essentially processes all of this information about your location in space. And it can use these two cameras within the HoloLens to sort of map the world around you. So it can put a grid over everything around you. And then you can put computer objects, programs, the visual representation of them onto your walls of your house, for example, to sort of like place it using your fingers, sort of tap in the air and then point to where you want it to go. And then have it sit there and connect to the physical universe or follow you around. We saw a demo where they had a robot that was a very simple robot based on something called Raspberry Pi, a small embedded computer. But they were able to project on top of that through the HoloLens this interactive 3D animated robot, like, you know, something out of the Jetsons, sitting on top of this robot, and you could interact with voice and things like that. And it also took the information from HoloLens and told the robot where it could go, mapped around objects so it didn't run into things, and you could make changes with it. And so the long-term benefit of this is that it's going to allow you to basically walk up to a device, walk up to anything where there's embedded computing in it, interact with it by voice. Something will pop up in front of your eyes and you'll get a menu of what's going on there, and you'll be able to talk to it, point at it, click on it, just like you would a web page on your computer.
Listeners, does this sound appealing to you, exciting, horrifying, this Jetsons future of holograms? Give us your opinion, your thoughts, your questions, your concerns. Your voice is always welcome here in the conversation at 410-662-8780. 1-800-930-2780. Aaron Henkin in for Dan Rodericks here on Midday. We're going to head to a break. When we come back, more on holograms, artificial intelligence, more thoughts from you on domestic surveillance, whatever's on your mind. It's Tech Talk here on Midday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Aaron Henkin here, filling in for Dan Rodericks. Here's a question for you. Can you imagine a future without television screens or laptops or any kind of computer screens, a future where holograms display all of your digital images out there in the physical world around you? Well, Sean Gallagher can imagine that. In fact, he has test-driven that very phenomenon. He was at the Microsoft Build Conference for developers, and he got a chance to take the Microsoft HoloLens for a spin. And Sean, tell us the story. You put on this, like, Star Wars blast shield, right?
So they actually held a little developer demo for us where they had us come in and write programs for this thing. And it was using an engine called Unity, which is used in the video game industry. And they had us build a game using objects they had already built that had designers build for us, and sound effects and things like that. And the thing about it is it's a 3D environment in which you can hear the noises of things behind you. It's stereo sound, so you can detect where things are by the sound. And I was actually pretty astonished by the sound as much as the visual. Because the visual, okay, it's a trick of the eye. It's not real holograms. It's using real light, not lasers and things like that. But it's doing something to make your eyes believe they see something three-dimensional. And we were able to build this game where we were knocking balls of paper around, where I could say something and a ball of paper would drop. It was a game called Origami that they had sort of built the code for us to write. And if you got it to drop onto this one target, the target would then explode and you would see a hole in the floor and would be able to look down through the floor into this underworld of flying origami cranes and things like that. So it was really very, very high resolution. It was very realistic. The main limitations of it are that it's just the area you have a view is about the size of, if you were up against your computer screen, there was no peripheral vision to it.
Okay.
There was a limit to the height of it, but it filled up most of your field of view. And you got a chance. You get an idea of how much of your field of view it filled up when you, say, set up the world to blow up above you, and you found yourself in the underworld and it filled up your whole screen.
This sounds like a novel way to waste a lot of time.
Well, it does, and I think it was originally intended for gaming, but I think Microsoft realized very early on that this was much more about other things than gaming. In the industrial world, in factories, for example, if you could see a situation where you've got a technician on a manufacturing floor and there's a problem with a piece of equipment and they need to understand how to fix it, if you walked up to it and then you just sort of tapped in the air and the schematics for it appeared in front of you along with arrows pointing where to fix things, for example. That's one of the demonstrations they gave, was basically a home plumbing situation where you could call an expert on plumbing, and the plumber would show you, would see what you were seeing, and then would give you, with visual cues, tips on where to go to fix something, and tell you what tool you needed, and show you what pipe was the problem. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, you could see in the industrial setting, in a military setting. The military has been working on augmented reality for a long time. Industry has been working on augmented reality for a long time. Boeing has been using it to build planes where engineers wear a monocle that shows them where the rivets are for certain things, where to put in pieces of equipment to match up with the airframe, for example.
Sean Gallagher is the Baltimore-based IT editor of the site Ars Technica. Also in studio with us, Ian Duncan. He covers intelligence and military topics for The Sun. And Sean, I interrupted you there because we have a listener who's got a very good question on just the subject we were just talking about. I want to welcome into the conversation at 410-662-8780, Carol in Towson. Carol, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'm a senior citizen. I'm far from a techie. And I was listening, don't understand it, but I'm gleaning something from it. You know, a lot of seniors, you know, and baby boomers are all becoming seniors, okay? A lot of seniors are have problems with, you know, doing things, okay, in their own home and don't want to go to assisted living or whatever and don't need to, but they just need more help. Are you going to have things that are less expensive, that are mass produced, that people can get installed in their various things in their house, and then you can walk up to them, or you know, and tell them what to do, you know, talk to the thing and it does it.
That's basically the idea behind another technology that I saw at the Build conference. Microsoft's got this thing called Project Oxford, which is an artificial intelligence capability that sits in, it's based on their search engine, Bing, and on some other technology. But basically what it does is it allows people to build devices that have speech recognition in them. They're able to understand what you mean, what your intent is when you talk to something. So if I said, show me the news for today, for example, it would know that I want to see news about from today, and it would find me that information. But that same technology can be built into just about anything. So yes, you could have devices around your house where you talk to them and you get information back from them, either spoken to you or potentially displayed on a screen or displayed on your phone or displayed on a HoloLens. And all of that information is sort of part of what we call the Internet of Things. These objects that have intelligence in them that connect back to the Internet, and they're able to retrieve information for you and send information back to other people. So, for example, in the medical industry, this is a big deal because home healthcare systems can now send information back to doctors, for example, where you could be wearing a device and it's talking over a wireless to the Internet and delivering information about your vital signs back to your doctor's office.
We've come a long way since those old Life Call commercials for the...
Yes, I've fallen and
I've fallen
can't
and
up.
I can't get up. Yes. Yes. Well, things have gone a long way from since then. This is Aaron Henkin in for Dan Rodericks on Midday, here with Sean Gallagher and Ian Duncan. I want to go back to an earlier part of our conversation. Listeners, if you're just joining us, we were speaking earlier this hour about the sort of blessing and the curse that is mobile technology, and that, you know, it gives you all of these great conveniences and privileges, but it also compromises your privacy, your civil liberties. And we have a caller here from the Eastern Shore, Alan, who has something to say to us about the tracking software on our phone. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to point out that most all of the capabilities of your smartphone, the Lord give us, but the Lord take us away. You can go into menu, one of the control menus. I think it's I forget the name of it, but it's up front where you make all your settings and everything, and you can turn off
right
the geolocating so that it doesn't know where you are.
Right, location services. You can turn location services off, and you can do other things to turn off geo-tracking by applications. It's fairly easy to do on Apple. It's less easy to do on Google, but it's still possible. The thing is that a lot of applications then break because they depend on those location services. And so, you know, if you're really concerned about privacy, yes, turn that off, please. Right? So go in and turn it off. I have it turned off by default on my phone for most of the applications on it, because some applications will access it even when you don't want them to, even when they're not on screen. So it's important to know what the settings are and how to turn them off.
I have an email here from a listener, and Ian, maybe you want to field this one. This is a listener who's got a question about the development of drones for not just for military use overseas, but for police and private use here among, you know, in our own cities, our own neighborhoods. What's the future here?
So it's definitely something that a whole range of people are interested in because, excuse me, it lets you get into the air much more cheaply than you can with a helicopter or a conventional aircraft. You know, the part of the way why these planes that we think the FBI were using, the advantage over a helicopter, is that they're cheaper and they can fly for longer, they're stealthier. Drones would be sort of the next step up from that they could do a lot of the same stuff, but much, much cheaper. It's not something that in Maryland is happening right now. I think there were some police agencies that were sort of interested in it and they faced a bit of a backlash, so they stopped. And there's still, the FAA is still sort of working out the rules for how people will fly drones in airspace with regular planes because they might crash into one another. And if you're piloting something from the ground, lots of the sort of usual techniques that you use to stop collisions don't work so well. So there's still a lot that needs to be done. Again, it's a double question of the technology and the policy around it and how you integrate those two things.
That's Ian Duncan. Sean, I want to turn to you. You actually wrote a really interesting article recently about drones being put to the purpose of battling poachers.
Yes.
Yeah, tell the story of this.
Right. So the Lindbergh Foundation started this project called Air Shepherd, which is attempting to sort of gather all these different technological research programs that have been undertaken, including one by the University of Maryland, to use drones to help rangers in parks in Africa protect the animals there from poachers. And the University of Maryland's Advanced Computing Center, and I'm probably screwing up the name there, but some folks at the University of Maryland built this algorithm originally to protect soldiers from improvised from IEDs, from improvised explosive devices, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And they used the same algorithms they designed to figure out where bombs would be placed to calculate where the most likely places poachers would go to attack rhinos and elephants. And they were able to pull in a bunch of different data from satellite data and from animal tracking data and things like that. And in places where they have tested this, where they use the software to tell drones where to go to look for poachers, poaching has stopped while the drone was in use. And the problem, of course, is that these countries, Kenya cannot afford to fly these things all the time, and South Africa is sort of leading the way on some of these programs. They've got
I'm sorry, but to interrupt you, these are obviously not armed drones.
No, they're not. They're relatively inexpensive. They're basically overgrown model airplanes.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And they're low cost, relatively speaking.
So they carry infrared cameras. They'll capture who's there and then send in the authorities.
All they do is spot people.
Right.
And if there's somebody there, I mean, not too many people go wandering across a game reserve,
right,
with a gun. So if you see somebody with a gun on their way towards where you know rhinos are, then you know they're poachers and you can intercept them. And this is making it a lot easier for rangers at some of these parks to actually get in between poachers and rhinos, the white rhino. The black rhino is now extinct in South Africa.
Drone program has come about because of the scale of this problem.
Yes, yeah. because there's this huge problem. It's a billion-dollar industry, poaching. There's huge amounts of money involved. There's a huge demand for rhino tusk in Asia, and that's why there are no more rhinos in Vietnam. The indigenous rhinos of Asia are gone, other than in zoos. And they've gone to Africa, and they're funding this. So these drones are being used to basically spot poachers. They're using software from a supercomputer to tell them where to go. That software has been brought down to a laptop now. So the hope is to raise a bunch of money to fund multiple teams like this to go out and protect rhinos and elephants.
There's the technology, and there's how it's used. Sean Gallagher is the Baltimore-based IT editor of the site Ars Technica. He's also our Midday on Tech contributor. He's been with us this hour. Also with us, Ian Duncan. He covers intelligence and military topics for The Sun. Thank you both, gentlemen. And I also want to say that lunch today was provided by Rosina Gourmet. Since 1999, Rosina Gourmet has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items. Rosina Gourmet, located in Canton, downtown Baltimore and Harbor East. Catering available by visiting rosinagourmet.com. Stay tuned for the second hour of Midday. We're going to speak with author Peter Slevin about his new biography of First Lady Michelle Obama. Stay with us.
More Midday up next here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Be sure to stick around this afternoon at 2 for Here and Now, Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture. And coming our way later today...
Watch out. Accident reported ahead. That's not your phone. It's mine, warning of a clogged intersection coming up. Smartphone apps do that and more when it comes to traffic. We'll take a ride to explore how traffic apps work.
They're all using the same data.
And how precise they can be. Later on All Tech Considered from NPR News.
All Tech Considered, during All Things Considered, this afternoon from 4 until 6:30, here on your public radio, WYPR. WYPR is a media partner for the Tea Party Festival in Chestertown, Maryland, from May 22nd through the 24th, offering a glimpse into Chestertown's colonial past in addition to entertainment, children's activities, crafts, wine and beer tastings, and more. Information's available at chestertownteaparty.org. Support for WYPR comes from WYPR members. We'd like to thank Charles Schaefer of Baltimore, Orly and Jeffrey Kahn, also of Baltimore, and Lois Sherry of Chestertown. Their contributions came in over the last couple days, and their pledges to WYPR are helping us shorten our late May membership campaign. The pledge drive was originally scheduled to last for a week, but when we reach our goal, it will be over. And thanks to all the folks who've already pledged, we're more than 31% of the way there. You can help us go all the way when you make your pledge online at WYPR.org. Pledge today or tomorrow, and you could win a Garmin Vivo Smart Activity Tracker. The deadline to get in on that drawing is tomorrow night. And if you pledge during this spring pledge drive, you'll also be eligible to win the last pair of tickets for the WYPR Travel Club's trip to Cuba. Find out more when you make your pledge online at WYPR.org. And thanks from all of us here at Your Public Radio, WYPR and WYPR HD1 Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, and WYPO Ocean City. It's 1 o'clock.
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Michelle Robinson was a rising lawyer at a prestigious law firm, an American success story. She was raised in a one-bedroom apartment on Chicago's South Side by parents who pushed and prodded and made her believe there was nothing a young black woman couldn't do. When she met a young intern who had dreams of running for office, she embarked on a journey that ultimately took her to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, where Michelle Robinson Obama became the nation's first African-American First Lady and one of the most visible, active, admired, and criticized women to hold that demanding job, which, by the way, she's handled while raising two young daughters. Peter Slevin, former Washington Post reporter, has written a biography of the First Lady. He joins us next on Midday, right after the news.